Welcome to Rico Soul Studios. We are a multimedia group that will be exploring the culture of La Raza, whether in Silicon Valley or throughout North and South America, Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central America. Rico Soul Studios podcast of Raza Voz will be broadcast at various times in English and Spanish and will be the platform that will allow us to bring you the stories and the voice of La Raza and how Raza has shaped the culture of Silicon Valley and all of the Americas. My name is Carlos Soltero, and I will be your host.
Raza women of the Santa Clara Valley have a long and impactful tradition of social activism. In that spirit, Raza Voz proudly introduces our first guest, Teresa Castellanos, and her daughter, Kitsan. Teresa is a wife and a mother and works for the Santa Clara County Office of Immigrant Relations. She serves on a school board and is a passionate advocate for immigrants' rights, women's rights, and education. So welcome, Teresa, to our first podcast.
Gracias.
We're going to begin with asking her some background questions. What would you like people to know about you? If you can talk about your upbringing, your family, and your work and education history, please.
That I'm an organizer, that I've been an organizer for about 30 years. That I grew up in San Jose, that my mother was a cannery worker. And that because she was involved in her union, we were involved in her union because that was a space that she took all her kids to. And since there weren't a lot of kids there, we got a lot of attention and it gave us awareness about unions and why unions were important. And even though she was just a seasonal worker, we knew that we had health benefits because of her seasonal work. And she had varicose veins that were get very swollen because of her work. And would burst, so there would be blood everywhere. So we knew that we had medical attention because of the work and that was important. So from a very young age, we knew that unions were important. I was a Spanish-speaking child in an English-only world. I didn't learn to read until fifth grade. But when I finally learned to read, my world changed. I went from being completely marginalized to being on the college track. I got into UCSC because of affirmative action. If there had not been affirmative action, there's no way I would have gone to college. And even though I was unprepared to be in college, it gave me an opportunity. And I remember struggling in college for 2 years where I was on academic probation for 2 years. But after 2 years, I learned how to be a good student and I graduated with honors. So, and while I was in college, it was really hard because it was such a culture shock. I was a graduate from San Jose High. Maybe we had faced racism, but until you go to college, you really don't know what racism feels like because it's directed towards you. And I had people tell me how wonderful it was that I got in for a free ride when they had been in college for five generations, when I knew that I had to start a paper 2 weeks before because I couldn't write and that I needed a lot of help. And so what helped me in college was that there was a frozen food strike, and I went to the rallies. We got arrested. For supporting the workers, and we were all the children of county workers and farm workers, so we got arrested. And then we got involved in teaching English and teaching reading and writing to the strikers. We ended up being involved there for 2 years, but it gave me a purpose in my education. And so when I finally had a purpose, I was able to learn to succeed. And so that purpose became using my education for social change.
Can you describe an incident that inspired you to become involved in social justice and what you did to get involved in social justice activism?
Well, I would say that it was my mom being a Teamsters, a union member. And in college, getting involved in the strike, because I was struggling with school. It was hard to be in school. And when I got involved in the strike, I had a reason to be in school. It wasn't about me. It was about my community.
You mentioned that you consider yourself a community activist. Can you talk about describe your approach to community organizing and who inspired you to learn more about the techniques of community community activism? And how you refined your techniques after learning from people who did this for a living and perhaps reading on how to organize the community?
I would say that my philosophy is I think we're all organizers and I think we're all leaders. Not everyone is given an opportunity. And I think as a humanity, we've been able to survive together, not by ourselves. And that's all our whole history. I mean, we don't have claws. We don't have teeth. So the way that we survive as human beings in nature is together. And so I think there is a part of us that brings us to organize, and there's a part of us that makes us leaders, but not everyone is given that opportunity. Obviously, I was influenced by the Chicano movement. I was influenced by Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta. I was influenced by the labor movement. I worked with the labor movement for about 10 years, and I learned about organizing in the labor movement. I worked with the Justice for Genders campaign. I worked with the Healthcare Workers campaign. And so there I was able to see, how does a team work? How does a team mobilize? How do you focus on issues that people really don't care about, but you need to bring attention to? So when I worked with the Justice for Janitors campaign, they were organizing Silicon Valley. And at that point, people didn't think you can organize undocumented workers. They thought all you have to do is call the migra and people leave. But reality is that the Mexican workers brought a sense of understanding how unions worked, and they were willing to be more open to unions than the regular population. And so now there's been 20 years of an immigrant rights movement with the labor movement. And so we realized, hey, they bring a lot of assets to this. But at that point, that wasn't the thinking. And so I've learned a lot from the immigrant community.
Can you talk about some of the issues involved in getting Chicanos and immigrants to communicate better and to work together?
I think we have more in common than there's difference, but I think we focus on the difference. And because we don't communicate with each other, because we don't talk about our histories, we don't get to the point where we understand each other. So, I mean, reality is Chicanos and Mexicanos live in the same place. Chicanos are not that much better off than the immigrant community. I mean, we have language, obviously. We have status, but we're working in the same spaces. And we're living in the same spaces and we're marrying each other. But we have not created that political space where we're talking to each other about what's the same, about what's different, about what we contribute. And to me, it's fascinating working in the immigrant community because a lot of immigrants have resentment towards Chicanos without realizing their kids are going to be Chicanos. And so it's this fascinating dynamic of the way that we're fragmented through racism and the way we're fragmented through internalized racism. And so I think that's a space that we have a lot of work to do and that we should be focusing on right now because we're all suffering together.
I have a lifelong interest in history, and I'm sure you do too. Can you perhaps talk about how important it is for Chicanos and Mexicanos to learn the history of the Chicano experience in the United States?
I think it's key because I think as long as we're fragmented, we're going to keep focusing on our little piece without realizing that there's more of us in the same space than less. And I think that's something that the Trump administration has given us an opportunity in, is to realize how many of us are in the same box and to say, oh, look who's in here too. I didn't know you were part of this box too. And I think that's the opportunity in organizing that we have right now, is to realize that we're more alike than we are different. Starting with, we live in the same place. We live at the same time. We have the same desires. We want a better future. And I think that's the historical moment that we're living.
Mm-hmm. I also feel that with the election of Trump, that it's an opportunity to bring us together. I remember when he was first elected, people were saying, oh, how terrible it's going to be, and how could we have done that? But I told some of my friends, I said, I believe strongly that this is a chance for people to wake up and to bring us together. So can you comment on that, please?
Well, I think without a doubt, the rest of the country is living what we lived when we passed Proposition 187. We're afraid of the demographic shift, too. And that was one of the markers that I had that got me involved in the immigrant rights movement, because I was working in the labor movement. And when 187 passed, we were organizing convalescent workers in Salinas, and I was there with some Filipino co-workers. And we went into this restaurant, and we felt so much rejection. It was a white restaurant, and everybody was staring at us, and maybe they were staring at us for different reasons. And 187 was a law that we passed in California that said the undocumented have no rights to anything in the state of California, to education, to hospitals, to library cards. It ended up being found mostly unconstitutional, but we did pass it as a law in the state of California through popular vote. And so there was a lot of rejection there. And what happened at that time was that we were having this immigration debate on the backs of children. Should we have to educate immigrant children? And so when that took place, I said, well, the most important thing I can do is make sure that I create spaces, support the creation of spaces for immigrants to become citizens. And so based on that, for the last 25 years, I've been working on promoting citizenship in the immigrant movement, because I do think we have more in common than we have difference. And I remember that day, the day after it was passed and we were walking into that restaurant, I felt like crap. And I was like, I feel like this, and I'm a fourth generation American. How does the immigrant community feel after this vote? And so I think we're living, I think the rest of the country is living what we lived 23 years ago. They're afraid of the future. And something that happened in 2014 was that Asian Latino and Black babies under two became the majority population for the whole country, not just for California, not just for New York, not just for Texas, but for the rest of the country. So the demographic shift has happened. And I think the white community has been told, you have less because of this community. And that's not true. You have less because we've created a hierarchy where the rich get mega rich and everyone else suffers. But we're blaming, there we're being stereotyped and the blame is being thrown on communities of color. But it's part of that fear of what's going to happen if things change. And I think California is a model for things did change. We do work with diversity and we're the economic engine of this country. And so good things happen in the context of diversity.
Can you discuss your view on women's rights and how there's been some positive changes made? It's been 100 years since women have been given the right to vote, and I think that's very impactful. So can you talk about women's rights issues, please?
Well, white women were given the right to vote 100 years ago. Women of color and people of color were given the right to vote 50 years ago. And that right was respected maybe for 20, maybe 30 years. And the last 20 years, we've been seeing rights taken away from people of color and their right to vote. And so I think it's important to celebrate that historical moment where some women got the right to vote. But I think we need to remember that not everyone got to the right to vote, and that we're living a time period where people are being denied the right to vote again. And so we have to keep fighting for our rights. And I think that's something that working in the social justice movement has taught me, is that every generation has to make social change relevant to them. Because if we don't, things can be taken away. And that's what we're living under the current administration, is that a lot of things are being taken away. Workers' rights are being taken away. LGBTQ rights are being taken away. Transgender rights are being taken away. And so things that we fought for and thought we won are being taken away. And so we need to know our history in order not to repeat it. And we know our history in order to fight for it.
In conclusion, Teresa, can you give some advice to a citizen who tells themselves, maybe I should start getting involved in these issues? What would you tell the citizen?
I would tell them that the most important thing they can do right now is be involved. And they get to define what that involvement is, whether it's voting, whether it's writing a letter, whether it's going to a rally. There are so many opportunities to be involved, and it's really important to be involved because we're living a time period that's scary. And the only way we are going to survive as a community is together. And the beauty of surviving together as a community is knowing that you're not alone, knowing that we can change things, and knowing that we can move things. And I think that's the beautiful time period that we're living, is where I get to go to a event in the Muslim community and I get to say, wow, this is my community too. I get to go to an event in the Japanese American community and I can say, oh, wow, this is my community too. And we need to stand together. And we need to protect each other because we are all we have.
Thank you very much for your time, Teresa. And the audience can clearly see that Teresa is a very passionate person and she strongly believes in social justice. And she's very involved in this and it's part of her life. And we want to thank her for her commitment and for the time she's given us. Thank you, Teresa.
Gracias.
Rico Soul Studios welcomes you back to the premiere episode of its Raza Voz podcast. In case you're just joining us, I am your host, Carl Soltero. We are going to continue the conversation with Teresa Castellanos' daughter, Quetzal Gomez, who is carrying on the tradition of community organizing that she learned from her mother.
Continuing our conversation about the role of women activists, Raza women activists in Santa Clara County, we now proudly present the daughter of Teresa Castellanos. Quetzal is currently working for Santa Clara County Office of Women's Policy, and she's a member of Latinx, I assume. And so what I want to do is focus on questions involving her upbringing. So the first question is, describe your upbringing as a daughter of social activist parents. Talk about your upbringing and education and your current work, please.
Hi. Yes, I'm Quetzal Gomez. So part of having parents that are social activists is that it's in your blood. It's something that you grew up surrounded by, and you eventually start doing it yourself as well. So We did have a lot of meetings we went to, joining our parents, a lot of marches, a lot of rallies. Eventually, we realized that this was something that we had to continue, and me and my siblings started organizing as well.
When you were doing the organizing and going to marches and protests, did you tell yourself, why can't I be like a regular kid and go to the park and do all those other things? Was that something that you found that was meaningful to you and that you got a lot of benefits from it, from going to these events and learning about what's going on in society?
Well, I don't think we understood what regular kids were doing. It was just our reality. Our primos were always with us as well. It was just the family culture. It definitely did influence our life paths. We realized that our parents were doing very important work, and we had to find out what our role in that work was and how we were going to continue the family legacy.
Can you discuss the term Latinx? I myself need to know more about that term and what it means, and also how the older generation needs to know about more about our current generation and more about Latinx. Can you talk about that, please?
Sure. So I personally identify as a Chicana. I still use the word Chicana instead of Latinx. I know that Latinx has a lot of weight to it in different circles. It is a term that a lot of people with education decide to use instead of words like Hispanic or Latinos. I know that it does want to recognize gender non-binary individuals in our community, and I think that's really important. But something that I think older generations need to understand about my generation, which is millennials, is that words matter to us, and how you use those words, whether it's our preferred gender pronouns or our political identities or even our political affiliations, those words really matter. So it's important for every generation to ask any individual what they prefer to be used. As a Chicana, I know that that identity and the birthing of that identity was something really important for our community. And so individuals who decide to go by Latinx or go by different gender pronouns, it's part of that same birthing of an identity. And birthing something is always something painful. And so having older generations acknowledge and respect those identities really affirms what we believe as young people.
Both your mother and yourself have used the term Chicana to identify yourself. Can you explain in your view what the term Chicana means?
Sure. I identify as a Chicana as a political statement. I am a fifth generation U.S. born citizen, but at the same time, it's only because Arizona was part of Mexico and the border crossed us, right? That's the only reason why we're that generation. We're native to this land. And so a lot of the times when people want to call us Mexican or Mexican-American, that's not the part of the identity we claim. But also the political part of that is that we acknowledge that we come from generations of activists and organizers who've been trying to better our community, and that we're part of that lineage of making sure that everyone in the barrios have the same rights and everyone in the barrios have the same opportunities, and being part of that legacy of continuing the work is why we call ourselves Chicanas.
Being involved in social justice issues, I'm curious, what are the social justice issues that you're involved in today, and what would you want people to know about these issues?
So in my work, in my official capacity, I work in two different areas of our office, and the first one is in women and girl leadership. We truly believe that we have to build a pipeline of leadership within our county to make sure that everyone is represented. In my second area, I work in the field of justice in women and girls in the justice system. So that particular area is really important to me because there's an overrepresentation of Latinas in the jail system in Santa Clara County. There's a statistic that always really moved me in my work, and it's that if a juvenile young Latina is involved in the juvenile justice system, so this means before she's 18, she's involved in the justice system, by the age 29 in Santa Clara County, she is 9 times more likely to be dead than her counterpart. And as someone who's 27 years old, that is a statistic that influenced my work greatly, because not only is it talking about a young person, it's talking about a Latina, it's talking about someone who can look and be me, right? And so in this work, I have to recognize that this injustice that's happening in our jails in Santa Clara County is affecting my sisters, my cousins, my friends. And so that's partly the social justice work that I do in the capacity as my role at the county. In my personal capacity, I'm one of the lead organizers of the Mayday Coalition. And the Mayday Coalition is a group of about 20 different organizations in Santa Clara County that work on immigrant rights issues year-round, but around 3 to 4 months of the year, right before May 1st, we get together and organize the May Day March. And for those of you who don't know what the May Day March is, it's the march on May 1st that happens every year. It's been happening for about 13 years now. And there was the big one that happened in 2006. When the 2006 one happened, I was just a kid. My parents were both organizers of the march. And because of that, we didn't march with our parents, but we marched with our tía and marched with our primos. And it became this family tradition that regardless of what day it landed on the week, just like many families in San Jose, we would take the day off of school or the day off of work and would march in solidarity with the immigrant rights movement. As I've gotten older and as the activist scene in San Jose has shifted, the coalition not only focuses on immigrant rights issues, but we also focus on immigrant rights issues, on women's issues, LGBT issues, and we want to focus it all on how all of these individual communities all join together, because we all have labor issues, right? We all are workers, we're all working class people, and we all work together to not only make our movement intersectional, but also make sure that, to make it clear that we can't win if we're not fighting together.
With the political climate that Raza lives in today, what would you tell a citizen as to what they should try to do to make this place a better place for all of us to live in?
So as a citizen, and I'm being in the literal sense as a U.S. citizen, I would tell, and I would specifically tell Latinas, run, Chicana, run. And that's something that my mom and me have been saying, and we're talking about run for office. We need to be in those seats. We need to be making those decisions. And without us in those seats, they're going to be continuing to make decisions for us, and they're going to continue to making decisions that supposedly represent our community. And so we need to run for office, and we need to be making those decisions.
Well, Quetzal, thank you for your time. Teresa, thank you. Two stories that I feel are very inspiring to women of Raza and to Raza itself in general. You can get involved. You can make this place a better place, and we can help each other to do that. And let's keep moving forward and make sure that Raza continues to have a place in this society. Thank you for your time, okay?
Thank you.
Rico Soul Studios, initial podcast of Raza Voz, focused on the role of women in the social justice movement. We hope that hearing about the experiences of Teresa Castellanos and her daughter Quetzal Gomez inspires more women of La Raza to engage in social justice issues that affect our community. Please go to our website for previews of our future interviews. We encourage feedback from our listeners, which you can share on our website at ricosoulstudios.com. Our email is info@ricosoulstudios.com. Raza Voz is a production of Rico Soul Studios, and the opinions expressed herein are not necessarily the opinions of Rico Soul Studios. Rico Soul Studios podcast of Raza Voz concludes its initial podcast, and we thank you for listening to your voice. For further information, we can be reached at 408-687-4816. Once again, our email is info@ricosoulstudios.com. Amor por mi raza.